Okay, welcome to our second session on the Bible and science. I have a clicker somewhere, right? Here we go. Last week we talked about bias, and I want to make another point about that. Everyone has their bias, and if you're an atheist, you're going to have materialistic explanations. You're going to take the information and fit it into a materialistic worldview. If you're a Christian, you're going to fit it into a biblical worldview. And we can't help that as human beings. It's just the way we are. And we need to recognize it when it happens, because a lot of what's being said in science is coming from those who have a materialistic worldview. When a scientist... Okay, this guy knows what he's talking about. He's a scientist. He's got a doctorate. And he says something that might have happened about something that might have happened in the past, once in the past. We have to recognize that that is speculative. It's not like he did this experiment yesterday in his lab, and if you don't believe it, you can do it in your lab. He's looking at evidence and saying this is what might have happened in the past. So he's speaking speculatively. If you assume he's speculative, you're in good shape. You can look at the evidence yourself, and I'm missing point three on the bottom of my slide. There's something with these new projectors. But point three says, let's be noble. Let's consider the evidence daily and see what it actually says. Sort of like the Bereans did, they considered the evidence. And were looking at that daily to see if it was true. Well, we can look at the evidence too and see if it's true. Just don't assume, because he's up here, Dr. So-and-so, and I'm just a lowly student or a layman, what do I know? He must know what he's talking about. Don't assume that he is not biased in what he's saying. Okay, here's a question. If I were not a Christian, would I believe in evolution? Does that question put me on the spot? Is there something in my scientific brain that says, I really would like evolution, but I can't go there because I'm a Christian? Not at all. The problem is with evolution and those who support it, they haven't made their case. That's the issue. They just have not made the case. Typically, when we have a theory, we want the evidence to support it, of course. Well, the evidence actually is against evolution. It's not neutral. It's certainly not supportive. It's not neutral. It is against evolution. So that's why I say they haven't made their case. Typically, in honest science, if you have a theory that's going to predict what we may find in the future, and then we go and find the evidence that relates to that subject, and we see that it doesn't support the theory, then we discard that theory and go on to another one. If theory A fails, we go on to theory B or C. Now, theory A, which is evolution, has failed. The evidence has failed to support it. But it's still there. It's still the reigning theory in all of science. And it's the uniting principle in all of biology. So why is that? Atheism doesn't have a theory B or C. It only has theory A. Evolution. Evolution has to be correct. If it's not correct, then their whole worldview is gone. It's not just that, oh, we'll go on to another theory and science as to how things might have originated or how we got to the diversity of life. We only have evolution, so it has to work. And that's why it is the unifying principle of all of biology. Well, yeah, it would be a unifying principle, I agree, if it were true. But it's not true because the evidence doesn't support it. Now, right from the very beginning, when Darwin put this forth, and he wasn't the first to come up with the idea of evolution, but he wrote the book and sort of gave a mechanism as to how it could occur. Right from the very beginning, there were problems, people not accepting it, because of paleontology. The fossil record did not support what evolution was saying should happen. Evolution was saying we start with a cell, and that changes a little bit and a little bit, and that becomes a what, and this becomes a... And all of life, the whole variety of life that we now have, came up in a very gradual way. It's called gradualism. So the fossil record should show a whole smear of different fossil forms. But the fossil record at that point in time showed distinct kinds and no links between them. Now, Darwin had a solution for that, or at least a hope that it would be a solution. And he proposed that, and we're going to talk about that later on when we get to our little session on evolution. But his promise, the time for his promise, has come and gone, and it was not fulfilled. The problem that evolution has with the fossil record is that it had in that day is the same one it has now 150 years later. The intermediates, which should be everywhere, there should be a whole smear of intermediates, and there is not a single intermediate for which a watertight case can be made that this is a transitional form between different types. And I'll show you some more examples of that. We talked about one last week. I'll show you some as we go on in the course. The Christian worldview is logically sound. Okay, there is no reason philosophically to say, oh no, that couldn't be true. So it is at least logically a possibility. And I would say evolution is logically a possibility too. So it's allowed logically. It, and only it, explains the evidence. And this is what this course is all about, and this is what I want to get into as we move along, as to why a God-centered worldview explains the evidence and a materialistic worldview does not explain the evidence. It just doesn't work. And the evidence is not only consistent with God, it requires God. It demands that there be a mind behind it. And I'll show you some quotes from some evolutionists who have come to the end of their career and look back on it and say, you know what? Materialism doesn't work. There must be a mind behind it. Now, they're not going to necessarily embrace Christianity because they don't like organized religion, and they've had a whole life of disliking that and hating it. So they're not going to embrace Christianity, but they will come to the realization that there must be a mind behind it. And as we move along, and I set a little more foundational work, you'll see why that's true. And the evidence is not coming from paleontology. I mean, paleontology has not been kind to evolution. It's been very unkind to it. But the evidence that we're going to see... Okay, let me, before I get to that, why doesn't materialism work? Materialism does not have the explanatory power required for the findings of recent scientific discoveries. Now, explanatory power is something we're going to talk about. What it does not have, it cannot... Materialism does not have what we call the probabilistic resources to explain and account for what we're finding in science. The whole universe, the known universe, does not have the probabilistic resources to account for the complexity that we found in biology. So the answer is not going to come from paleontology. The real evidence that we're going to be talking about is coming from biochemistry and the complexity that has been discovered in the last 50 or 60 years that we had no idea. We had no idea that that complexity was there. Now, I want to talk about asking questions. A lot of you have questions. I know from the survey that there are some very fundamental questions about God. Is God necessary? Is it okay to ask any question? Is the Bible really true? Is the Bible true when it speaks about science? A number of you are questioning some very fundamental things. Is there a God? Is God necessary? Is God really necessary to explain how life became what it is. I mean, everyone believes, I don't care if Christian or atheist, whatever, everyone believes there was a time on earth when there was no life. And now, obviously, there is life, right? I mean, that everyone believes that. That's not a question. So there's a question, how life arose, and then how did it diversify into all the various life forms that we have around us today, including ourselves? How did that happen? So is God necessary? Now, that's the question that I went through when I was in college. So that was a long time ago. And I was really struggling with, was God necessary to explain the diversity of life? Was evolution really true? And I was just sort of pasting God on there where he wasn't really needed. So that's the question that I was asking myself. And I went through this where I was asking God, do you really exist? Is it okay to ask that question? I mean, is it offensive to ask God if he exists? I don't think so. Not at all. My life experience says no. In fact, if you have that question, some of you do. Does God really exist? Or is God really necessary? Are we just Christians sort of pasting him on over where he's not really needed? And we could explain it all without God. You have to ask that question. It's not a question, is it okay? It's a matter of having to ask that question. And I suggest, my experience was that you ask that question in a humble way. And why not? I mean, I cried out to God, God, do you really exist? If you really exist, I want to see the evidence. And he gave me the evidence. And a lot of what I'm talking about this summer is a result of what happened to me way back when. I don't want to say how long ago it was. No, I can't remember so far back. No, I remember what he taught me in those days, and it's still with me today. And I'm very happy to talk about it and tell you all about it, because I know some of you have the very same questions. If you're questioning, is there a God? Well, I was right there with you at one point, and I asked him about it, and he answered that question for me. It took a good part of a year that I struggled with that, and God was so nice and gracious to me. God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble. Okay, I want to tell you a story about two men who doubted, and they had questions for Jesus. And one of them was in very dire circumstances, and he asked a question to Jesus. The other one asked the question in almost a defiant way. And it's interesting to see how Jesus responded to each of these men. First one was John the Baptist. When he was in prison, heard of the works of Christ, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, are you the expected one, or shall we look for someone else? Now, how did Jesus answer that question? Did he say, John, you're the one who said, behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. You were there. You baptized me. You saw the heavens open. You saw the Spirit descend on me. You heard a voice from heaven saying, this is my Son. And now you're asking, am I the Messiah? Or should we wait? What's the matter with you? No, Jesus didn't respond that way. We do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with us in our weaknesses. We have a wonderful God who does sympathize. He knows that we're weak. He knows that we have problems. He knows that we have doubts. And he's sympathetic to that. What a wonderful God we have. In my own life experience, I said, God, do you really exist? And he showed me the answer, and it's wonderful. God is wonderful. So what did Jesus do? Did he say, oh, yeah, go, sure, yeah, go tell John I'm the Messiah. You talk to me directly? And I said, yes, I confirmed it. I'm the Messiah. No, he didn't do that either. What did he do? You know, there were predictions in the Old Testament, the scriptures at that time, that when the true Messiah came, and they were waiting for that Messiah, when the true Messiah came, certain things would happen. And that would be evidence that this was, in fact, the Messiah. So Jesus said, yeah, go tell John what you've seen and heard. The blind receive their sight. The lame walk. The lepers are cleansed. The deaf hear. The dead are raised. And the poor have the good news preached to them. So what did Jesus do? He gave John evidence. He gave him evidence to strengthen his faith. God is in the evidence-giving business, right? I can't put my hand in front of this and push the button. I've learned that. Okay. Thomas. The Apostle Thomas, one of the 12, called Didymus, was not with them when Jesus came. This is after the resurrection, of course. The other disciples, therefore, were saying to Thomas, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I shall see in his hands the imprint of the nails, and put my finger into the place of the nails, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." Wow, that's pretty bold, I think. And how did Jesus answer him? Did he say, when they came together, did he say, "Thomas, you want to stick your finger into the nail holes? How gross is that?" No, he didn't say that at all. He didn't respond that way. Again, I would have responded that way. He said to Thomas, "Reach here your finger and see my hands, and reach here your hand and put it into my side." He gave him exactly the evidence he was asking for. And he didn't ask in a real nice way. "Oh, gee, I wonder, you know, I'd like to see this." No, he demanded to see it. And how did Jesus respond? He gave him the exact evidence. "Put your finger here. Put your hand here. And see for yourself." He gave him evidence. Jesus gave Thomas evidence to strengthen his faith, just like he did to John the Baptist. He responded the same way. We have a God who is compassionate and sympathizes with us in our weaknesses. And you know what? That was 2,000 years ago. Is it relevant today? Sure, 2,000 years, that's nothing to God. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday and today and forever. The way he responded in biblical times is the same way he responded to us today. He's perfect. And what's perfection going to change into? More perfect? No, he is the same as he always has been. He's in the evidence-giving business, and I can confirm that in my own personal experience, and it wasn't 2,000 years ago, although I am very old. Okay, I want to take a look at a couple of quotes that we looked at briefly last week and just explain them a little bit more. I just sort of threw them out there as kind of threatening quotes for Christians last week. This week I want to talk a little bit about it. Although atheism might have been logically tenable before Darwin, Darwin made it possible to become an intellectually fulfilled atheist. So what did Darwin do? He codified thoughts that were out there. He put them together. What did Darwin actually do? He provided a possible mechanism by which the first single life form could have, the single cell, could have evolved into everything else that there is today by a materialistic means, not requiring any kind of supernatural intervention. He provided what was supposed to be a mechanism to show how a single cell could evolve into everything else that there is today in life, including ourselves. And that was the hope. Now, as I said a moment ago, paleontology says no. The fossils say no, it didn't happen that way. But Dawkins is taking it and saying he made it possible to become an intellectually fulfilled atheist. Now we have a way. We have a mechanism to support our atheistic views, and that's evolution. It happened, and no God is required. But evolution doesn't work. Paleontology, we've talked about, biochemistry, we'll get into that as we move along through the summer. This biology textbook statement: "Evolution is considered to be one of the best established facts of all science. The proof and the evidence are abundant." So you get students reading this, high school, college students reading this sort of thing. And I don't know where to start on this one. You know, I really can't go into it all. The word evolution has multiple meanings. They're not talking about that. They're just sort of hiding that in there. And to say the proof and the evidence are abundant. Well, the proof and the evidence for what? Some proof and evidence is abundant, but the proof and evidence for evolution of single cell to everything else there is not there. This statement I consider to be intimidation. You're intimidating the students. Anyone who questions the reigning theory, there's something wrong with you. They can't be questioned. Now, where in science do we have a theory that can't be questioned? Why can't it be questioned? Of course it can be questioned. Honest science allows questioning. Why do we have to shut off the questions? Why do we have to protect the reigning theory? Because it's weak. And they know it. In their heart of hearts, I really believe that they do know it. Julian Huxley, in 1960, you can see he was 73 years old, and he made this statement in 1960, there is no longer either need or room for the supernatural. Now, he's hoping that's true. He spent his life promoting that sort of idea. And 73 years old, he's saying that in 1960. He did not know in 1960 he was standing on the threshold of the greatest explosion in knowledge, particularly in biological science, that we've ever known in the history of mankind. He didn't know it at that time. We know it now. We look back on it and see, okay, he was unaware of where he was standing. He was on the threshold. And he was looking back on his career at age 73 and saying, you know, we don't have any need for God. And he was speculating. He was still speculating. There wasn't hard evidence to prove that. He was speculating that that was true. He believed it with all his heart, of course. He was wrong. And the findings of modern science over the last 50 or 60 years show that he was wrong. And the reason is materialism does not have the explanatory power to deal with the complexity that we have discovered. No one knew. No one knew that that complexity was there. We now know it. Once the barrier of evolution had been removed, it was so much easier to believe the Bible and accept Christ. This was from Ken Ham and a 23-year-old quoted in his book, Creation Evangelism. Evolution is a barrier if you don't understand it. If you understand evolution and what it really means, it's not a barrier because it's just not true. It does not work. Slides are a little messed up here. It has something to do with these screens. And hopefully we'll have that straightened out by next week. Okay, what is the best way to reason through and understand how the Bible and science correlate? Should we do this? Although evolution is the reigning theory in biology, it's more likely, much more likely, that God did it, so it makes more sense to believe the Bible. Let's see if we can get a little answer here. Yes. Things have moved. Okay? That is supposed to it's supposed to be down a little bit, okay? No. The answer, of course, is no. My little circles aren't going to work. I can see that. I got a couple more coming. Anyway, although evolution is a reigning theory in biology, it's more likely. The problem with this particular statement tempts you to commit a fatal error in assuming that evolution is reasonable. It is not reasonable, and I'm going to show you that as, you know, we've got a whole summer, we're just beginning. It's not reasonable, and we shouldn't automatically allow for, oh, it's reasonable. And it's much more likely that God did it? No. It's certain that there is at least, I mean, if you don't want to take a Christian perspective, if you just want to say, okay, let's look at the evidence, I'm not a Christian, it's obvious that there has to be a mind behind it. and I'll show you why. It's so obvious and evident. And some of the atheists, famous atheists, are actually admitting that now. And I'll show you the quotes as we're going. I know science says something else, but I'm just having faith and trusting the Bible. That's what faith is all about. We're going from bad to worse here. This is terrible. Never. That is not what faith is all about. That has nothing to do with faith. That's sticking your head in the sand and not facing the evidence. As Christians, we don't have to worry about facing the evidence because all truth is God's truth. And we can look at an honest interpretation of the evidence, honest interpretation of the Bible, and those two are always going to correlate. They will always agree. So that is not what faith is about. Just sort of, okay, I know, but I'm going to believe the Bible anyway. No. That's horrible. You don't have to take that position. No. I predicted that. The Bible is true in general, but scientifically it's a little out of date in some ways. Well, I'd have to let the theologians answer this for me, but the Bible, I know, is not a technical book on science. The Bible is a book on God and man and redemption. Is that correct? Yeah. Okay. Who? Ward would say yes. Is Ward? I don't see him here. Okay. God, man, and redemption. That's the focus of the Bible. And that has eternal value and consequences. Whether man evolved or not is something we're dealing with now that doesn't have necessarily eternal consequences. Now, they're important questions because it becomes a barrier in someone's mind to accepting what the Bible says. So the Bible says certain things that have scientific implications, like in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and all things were made through him. God spoke, and what didn't exist came into being, and molecules obeyed his voice better than we do, right? So the Bible does make statements about, you know, they have scientific implications. And those statements are true. And I'm very happy to tell you about those. And that's a challenge, and I take that on willingly. Now, I think, yeah, okay, how did I know that was going to happen? New screens, okay? And why that's causing this, I'm not sure. Now, no boy. Okay, I already said that, so that we don't need that. Let's go on. Okay, timeline. Who knows what happened in 1859? Oh, come on, I'm devastated. Who knows? Help me. What happened in 1859? Yeah, Darwin, Dr. Lamb. Thank you. You have to have a doctorate to answer this question, okay? Darwin published The Origin of the Species, and that's what set it off. That's why we can be now intellectually fulfilled atheists, because he made this proposal, gave a mechanism by which it could happen. We just didn't have to think, oh, there's no God, it could happen. Now he gave a scientific validation on how it could happen, but it doesn't work, as it turns out. What happened in 1953? Watson and Crick. Okay, thank you, Dr. Lamb. Watson and Crick discovered the structure of DNA. Okay? We knew DNA was there. We just didn't know what the structure was. Now, once the structure of DNA was discovered, that's what opened the scientific revolution in biology. Because then we began to understand how things worked. When I was in graduate school, we knew this, of course, but we didn't know all the complexity and what was going to come out of that knowledge. I mean, how many PhDs in biology are there out there now that were never there before? How many research projects are going on that were never there before and publishing all the papers and learning all of these things and filling in the gaps in our knowledge? Oops. Okay, so there it is. Darwin, Origin of the Species, Watson, Crick, Structure, DNA, Knowledge Explosion. And just 2016, that's this year. So we had about 100 years between Darwin and Watson and Crick before we really understood the complexity of all things. And we don't fully understand it now, but we knew, wow, this is big. We didn't know this was going to all be there. And there it is right before our very eyes. Well, before that happened, we had 100 years for Darwin to reign and be supreme and for atheism to really take foothold and become a faith, a fundamental faith. Atheistic fundamentalism had that 100 years to develop. And when that happens, you don't cut it off right away. We've had now, you know, 50 or 60 years of this scientific revolution, and we should be putting it to rest. But when someone is an atheistic fundamentalist, they're not going to give that up. My prediction is that generation is going to have to die out. The problem is they're teaching the next generation. So we'll have to see what happens. I think over time, as people look honestly at it, we're going to see belief in evolution is going to be like a relic of the past. Well, how silly they were, they believed in that. That's my prediction. Okay, I'm going to stop here, okay?
Okay, just like we'll do every week, this is question and answer time, so we want this time to be different than the preaching time, right? We don't want this to be just a presentation of material, but we want to give you the opportunity to interact.
Great.
So we set aside the last section for you to ask questions of Jerry. And Jerry, I had a request last time.
Am I preaching?
That you would that you would please repeat the questions.
Yes,
because sometimes
right.
people didn't hear
I
the questions
last time. I tried to do that,
time,
and I was not
we apologize
totally
for
consistent.
That.
Okay.
So yeah, we just turn it over these next 10 minutes, question and answer time. And feel free to raise a hand and go ahead.
Yes, Forrest.
Of course,
I've had hey. That's true.
Right.
The question is about the fossil record, and most things don't leave behind fossils. That's true. Like all the buffalo that were killed, where are they? They're eaten up. You have to have a catastrophic event or something happen to bury it quickly before it decays or whatever. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Discovered other skeletons that had planted teeth, flat sort of teeth. Where do you stand on that? I mean, obviously, it could be interesting. You can see teeth and say, well, this looks like it belongs to the animal.
Okay, the question is, where do I stand on the teeth of a particular dinosaur? Okay? I'm not a paleontologist. I'm a biochemist, and we don't study teeth. So, I'm sorry, that's a valid question. You're just asking the wrong person. You know, it's funny. If you have, in medicine, if you have a problem with your knee, you don't go to the dentist, right? If you have a toothache, you go to the dentist. You don't, not the orthopedic surgeon.
I didn't quite understand the question.
Well,
it's sort of like
you've got certain fossils that may support evolution. Like that, like if you see a dinosaur that has, what do you mean?
Evolution.
No, I'm not saying it supports evolution. I'm just asking him if he has seen evidence that he can't explain away.
He thinks too much.
Yeah.
Kind of a direct answer to your question. The type of teeth definitely gives you a very good indication, but not an absolute indication. Oh. Of what, it's like we put corn out to track deer, and then we found foxes coming eating the corn.
Right. Yeah, so, I'm just asking you in generalities, if you do see something that you can't directly explain away, like those teeth. Like, I mean, how would you explain the teeth? Would you just say that it's just false? Okay,
what I don't get is there's no connection between the dinosaur that had teeth that would indicate it's a carnivore and
then there's a transition to the dinosaur that has teeth that are flat would indicate eating plants.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look at all animals most animals that have flat teeth eat plants.
Right.
If you have the same species of animal, relatively different time periods that have got different types of teeth, right, you know it's the same species of dinosaur.
Okay, let me say something about that. I think I see where that's going. And when I talk about evolution, that's going to come up, but let me tell you my feeling on that. When we talk about evolution, okay, he had this shape teeth once, now he's got this shape of teeth. I have no problem with that. That's adapting to your environment. And God has built that flexibility within the various kinds. If the environment changes, the species can change a little bit within certain limits to adapt to the environment. And that's just the wonder of what God has made. If it gets cold, the animals with long hair are going to live. If it gets warm, the animals with short hair. I mean, changes in length and shape, that's certainly variation at the same level of genetic complexity. I have no problem with that at all. No one does. It's just the flexibility God has built. Now, if you said, okay, this dinosaur had no teeth. Now, no teeth at all. And now all of a sudden we've got teeth and all the genes that are required to make teeth, then I would have a concern about that. Well, gee, how did that happen? How did that new genetic information arise? We're not really talking, when we talk about differences in shapes, length, size, color, though that's not evolution in the kind that Darwin was talking about. How do we go from a single cell to all the variety of life there is today? How do we go from a little bit of genetic information to tons of new genetic information, very specific, and how does that happen? That's different than saying, oh, he has this shaped teeth, now he has this shaped teeth. That could be a mutation, or that could be a variety that already exists within the species, and because now we have more plant food to eat, not much animal food or whatever, the guys with the flat teeth that can chew up the vegetables, they're going to survive better. So we have survival of the fittest. Yeah, I agree with it, no question at all. Forrest. Okay, now for another question. Let's go to Forrest.
No, it's just interesting. So you think that there is a certain level of I put me on the spot with this microphone.
Yeah. Hey, I'm on the spot. You know, I mean, how many people here seek opportunity to speak in front of a large group and maybe give a multiple week series on some topic? Well,
so whether you believe in a certain amount of autonomy, I guess between. Survival of the fittest does fit in there.
Sure.
You're saying that animals can adapt?
Animals can adapt within certain limits. And those are genetic limits. And when you say that, I'm not thinking teeth. I'm thinking of DNA, okay, because that's where my mind is. And these are my introductory remarks, you know. So we're just sort of scraping the surface and not going too deep anywhere. Dr. Lamb.
You do need to distinguish between adaptation and what he's talking about. Bible in no way prohibits animals from adapting within a kind. Kind is not a species. Kind is a broader term, like dog kind, horse kind, so on. There's no question, there's no problem with some horses being small and some horses being big. It's adaptation to the environment. God gave animals and plants the ability to adapt to a constantly changing environment. That is not evolution.
I like what he said. Okay. No. And I know, look, I know Forrest is not like saying I disagree. He's just raising a question, okay? Dr. Rhodes. Okay. The only doctors, okay?
The species adapt in the situations that they're faced with, to face those situations more effectively. And that's one type of adaptation that I think is what you've been talking about. But there's also adaptation of genetic code. You'll get changes within the genetic code that happen. It doesn't make a new species, but that allows for that adaptation.
Right. There can be changes. There are two possibilities in my mind as to how species adapt to the environment. One of them is it could be a gene that's already present. Like gene for short hair could be present in animals with long hair. Or that there could be a point mutation, a very small change in the genetic material at the same level of genetic complexity that all of a sudden introduces a new feature in that length or color or something like that. Mark?
Yeah, I was just going to make a brief comment that what is being discussed here I think can just be understood as a contrast between macro evolution and micro.
You're stealing my thunder.
Okay. Well, that it's important to say that because one is not the other. And the other is not the one.
They're very different biochemically. They're worlds apart.
And I'll just say that Darwin's Origin of Species, his bona fide evidence in that book, is largely micro.
It's all micro. It's all micro, and he speculates from micro to macro.
Exactly.
Okay.
Would you recommend Dr. Stephen Meyer's book, Signature in the Cell?
Yeah, Dr. Meyer has written a book, and this is my last question, sorry. I'll be available afterwards. The Signature in the Cell by Stephen Meyer, I think is that like 2008 or something like that, is an excellent book. It's kind of thick, and if you really want to pursue this subject, Forrest, please get that book. It will be very helpful to you. Signature in a Cell, Stephen Meyer.